what the hell are people doing with all this vacant office space? Because you can't convert it to resi.
And I think everybody's finding out it's a lot more costly and riddled with a lot more risk than anyone realized.
I was going to say that's the worst part of the affordable housing business. I like to say the affordable housing business is a great way to get rich slowly and painfully. Could be a pretty interesting part of town that's going to be growing a lot.
I love Dallas. I love everything about Dallas. The worst deals that we've made are with the least motivated sellers.
Today's episode of the Real Estate Anonymous podcast, we're getting into Dallas, Texas, what is true, and Brett's take on Shakespeare. Hope you enjoy.
Today's podcast sponsor is RE Cost-Seg, the premier provider of cost segregation studies founded by my friend Mitchell Baldridge. Are hefty tax bills eating into your real estate income? RE Cost-Seg can help you save significantly on taxes and increase cash flow. Their expert engineers uncover opportunities for accelerated depreciation, delivering accelerated tax savings and valuable insights. With over $225 million in tax savings for clients, they're here to support investors of all levels and sizes. Visit RE Cost-Seg, RECOSTSEG.com/REAPOD for a free proposal and start saving today.
Right. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening. Whenever you're listening. Good morning.
Good morning.
Elliot White, Brett Moss, Eric Weatherholtz. Episode 2 of Real Estate Anonymous podcast. Does that sound right?
That's right.
Guaranteed to be orders of magnitude better than the first.
You can only go up.
For those of you joining on YouTube, I've scrapped the undershirt. You'll get a little free chest hair as part of today's edition. We got a good one today, talking through kind of a multifamily hotel industrial thing in Dallas next to some development. It'd be fun to talk about. Before we get into it, Brett, you got anything new going on in your world? How's life as a broker?
It's not easy. I don't know the last time that any sellers enjoyed pricing from that the market has been indicating that they are where they are. And so at least it's consistent over the last couple years. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a slog out there, but got to keep taking swings at it, as we'd say.
People are still unhappy to hear from you.
Once offers come in, they're not really that happy to hear from us.
I've had those conversations on the other side with brokers where I said, it's not, I just don't know how you're getting to that number. And they say, yeah, we kind of feel the same way.
Trust them. Yeah. Famous last words of a broker. No, I trust them.
Yeah. Agreed. Noted. No, so you're not a buyer at a 4 cap, huh? Okay.
Right. Right.
Eric, what's up with you, sir?
I've just been amused with the, I got a couple of emails this week about opportunistic office investments, opportunistic office investors investing opportunistically in offices, and the buyers, those are the buyers, and then the sellers in these cases were also opportunistic office investors now selling office opportunities to other opportunistic office investors looking for opportunities that may or may not have come to be the opportunity that they were originally thought to
you don't
be.
Sound so skeptical about this
turtles
at all
the way down. Kind of fun to see. yeah it's providing opportunities for others.
I think you have to say you're opportunistic to get involved in office because you're saying, well, we're targeting a 30 IRR. There's a chance we get $0. And it's like, yeah.
Right.
That's probably
that's the
right.
opportunity.
What the hell are people doing with all this vacant office space? Because you can't convert it to resi. You just can't. I mean, you can, but it's almost more expensive than scraping it and building new. So
It sounds good in a ULI presentation, but when you come back to peeling back the layers of the onion, I think everybody's finding out it's a lot more costly and riddled with a lot more risk than anyone realized.
Eric, I think we talked about it.
Yeah, it's almost the office world is – the office product has changed. Like if you've got a – you know, the two places I've seen, a friend of mine has a small little 5,000 square foot drive up, super cool building in a groovy part of town, and he can't keep tenants away. You know, folks that are building these really highly amenitized, you know, 100,000-ish square foot buildings in cool parts of growing cities, tons of demand. It's those big, you know, CBD 1980s buildings. That's just a tough deal. And there's, I walked through one recently and it's just bleak. They all go, there's one, in Atlanta I went by, in the last couple of weeks, was a no question class A building in the 90s. And it had that funky smell of an old office building, you know, and you just, I just don't know what you would do with it. The thing had top of the market rents, you know, 20, 25 years ago. They can't find.
What's that great line from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas where he's describing, I think, Benicio Del Toro, and he goes, there he goes, one of God's own creatures, too weird to live and too rare to die.
Yeah.
It sounds like what's going on there.
But they should rent a convertible and drive to the desert as fast as they can.
I hung out with Benicio in high school, by the way. Cool cat.
Did you go to high school with him, or you guys just sort of came across one another?
Yeah, he went to the same high school and had some mutual friends. And I decided not to go into acting, but
that's,
he did.
You think that's been the difference, just the choice you made? I decided not to go into the NBA, too.
Right.
I had the best jump shot in all of the eighth grade, but I gave it up early. not a whole ton new here in my world. I'm still in Texas on site. I think we had another 2-3 weeks here. For those of you who don't know, I make my bread and butter in the affordable housing business. And this week's been a lot of getting units ready and walking into units and getting leased up. Certainly one of our properties. And the thing we talk about from time to time, and not to be a real downer on this morning edition, but is the condition that you walk into some of these units and you see kids in there, you see dogs in there and cats. It's tough. You know, they're sure. People are, and I think if you were to ask any of those residents, if you pull them outside and you go, should you clean up your apartment? Should your kids not be living among animal feces? And should you not be like abusing your pets and stuff? I think in a vacuum, they all say, yeah, sure, right? I should do X, Y, Z better. But you get, and I've experienced it myself, but you get kind of real close to the margins and there's a level of depression that sits in. And so it's really hard for some of these folks to clean their place. It's not just that they are sort of lazy assholes who don't want to. I think it's important to be empathetic and understand that sometimes life is just super hard. And but it sucks to walk in and see it and you just sort of shut the door behind you and you're off to the next unit. You know that like right now, right, that is still going on. And people ask me, obviously, that's the worst part of the affordable housing business.
That's a serious difference between, you know, you look at real estate as a some sort of a financial mechanism. And it's, you know, especially in the residential side, it's got a very human component to it that can't be at all discounted, especially if you're a hands-on person. That's a really tough thing to deal with.
Yeah, it's not great. And you sort of develop these operating calluses where you can just, you know, that sometimes you're going to see that, and you either get used to it and learn to get comfortable with it, or the business sort of spits you out. Because I know people who have just said, I can't fucking do this anymore. I can't go to another unit. Uh-huh. I can't see this. I'm going to go sell insurance to old people. I'm fucking done. You know, like I'm tapped out.
Yeah.
right.
But yeah, it's an interesting part. I'm interviewing a head of asset management, and one of the conversations I had with him was, he's coming from the institutional side, was about the balance between what's the right return and what's the right thing. And that's if you can do it right, you can make a difference in some people's lives in affordable housing, but it's tough.
Well, I would say that
you got to get your head right.
And I would say the, you know, kind of residential rental space, whether it's multifamily or anything else. I mean, it's the only place in the commercial real estate arena that's playing to one of the basic human needs of shelter. Yeah. So, but it, I agree with Elliot's comment that it can be emotional at times for sure.
Yeah. That's why our we don't get much of that fun stuff. We're dealing with things like yoga pants and bars and restaurants.
You've chosen well. Yeah.
Flower shops. And,
I like to say the affordable housing business is a great way to get rich slowly and painfully. All right, gents, should we jump into it here and talk about what we got to talk
about?
Let's
do it.
Let's move to Dallas. So let me
pull this up here for everyone.
Now that we're sufficiently depressed, let's talk about
after
Dallas.
Dragging you guys through the dirt like that.
The Texas miracle.
So I assume you all can see on my screen here what we've got.
Sure.
So it's an interesting deal. It's called the Butler Brothers Building. It's downtown Dallas near City Hall. It's been there forever. It was recently renovated by the group who owns it now. This deal is out on the market. Didn't trade, but I thought it was interesting. You've got a mix of residential, hotel, retail. You got some parking stuff going on, proximity to a development site. So I will just kind of spin through. It's located on Hervey Street in Dallas. Get to an overview. So nine-story building. You've got 237 apartments and a 274-room dual-branded hotel. They share the same building, but obviously the entrances and the hallways and everything that is demised separately. You're actually able to buy this deal. You could make an offer on either the whole thing combined, or you could buy just the residential or just the hotel. The current owners own the whole package combined, but recognize that they're probably buyers who are better fit for one for the other. We only looked at it on the residential side. I don't know anything about hotels. It's not my sweet spot. I think I could get my lunch eaten pretty quickly in the hotel space. And so I didn't feel comfortable going after that. Try to stay in our lane here. And then you've got some first floor retail. This is an overview of the site. Both buildings, you can see it's obviously one building, but residential and hotel. Retail on the first floor, parking structure. You can see off to the left here. I think it's a 4 or 5 story parking structure. And then you've got a parking lot that comes in as well. Both the hotel and the residences have their own dedicated pools. It's kind of interesting how they've broken the space up. You can see the residential in blue, the hotel component in green. And so a couple interesting things about this deal is you have to know that I think there were two vacant retail spaces here. And I don't know the best mix for retail in this particular area. You got a lot of government employment, and it's not a super high traffic spot at the moment, but there's a lot of redevelopment coming to this part of Dallas, and we'll kind of touch on that in a bit. And it's one of these great old, kind of looks like an old mill building on the inside, and the sellers have done an excellent job with it. They've renovated all the units into much bigger units than I think would be typical for the market. You've got a lot of the exposed HVAC and wiring and plumbing and, you know, just kind of has that cool mill building look while they've done a nicer, more modern wrapper on the outside.
Have you walked it?
Yeah.
Have you seen the inside? Are they really deep spaces? So big, but deep.
So you're really trying to pull all the lighting you can in from the big windows at the front. So yeah, big, but deep units. And that's what's tricky with these. Sometimes you get these old mill buildings in, you know, at least in New England, we've got them where they're probably 60 feet wide. That was just the right width for manufacturing. So you get these long 60 foot wide brick buildings, and they work perfectly for this double loaded center corridor. This one's got a bit more of a kind of wonky shape to it. So there's not a ton of consistency. I think there are 17 or 18 different floor plans just for the two bedrooms.
How about ceiling heights? It's usually those.
Yeah,
are pretty
good. I mean, 10, 12 foot clear. It was, you know, they were real big. Let's see if I can find exactly what it is in here.
Super cool.
We'll see if we can pull up some photos. They're talking about maybe redevelopment potential on top.
There's a big convention. The new convention center is planned kind of right in this pocket of downtown too, right?
So the Omni's there. The new convention center is going to get renovated. There's a couple different development firms that have large master plan projects in this part of town. And so some of it is you're obviously looking at what's the current income stream. And then most things, you're also looking at what do I think is going to happen in this neighborhood. I think some of these development projects are pretty interesting. The only really thing that kind of stood out, I mean, you've got to get there on pricing, but you can see an overview of kind of renderings of what is this going to look like. And so our property, the subject property is down in the right-hand corner of the screen, and then a lot of these renderings are showing these new development projects fully masked once they come in, the new convention center. So could be a pretty interesting part of town that's going to be growing a lot. You've got to have a lot of conviction that these projects are all still going forward as planned at their original scale. And I just don't know enough to say whether they are or they aren't. But if they are, and this becomes a pretty booming part of town, I think this is an interesting acquisition.
Well, you would think any city in the United States that has a chance to pull off some or all of this would be Dallas, in my opinion.
I would think so. And this is a overview, kind of a Google map or satellite view, and then they've laid over some of these development districts. And and what's interesting, if you spend any time in downtown Dallas, there's some stuff going on around the AT&T Design District. You can see that sort of in the middle, upper left of the screen. But there's not as much happening. There's a lot going on in Uptown. There's a lot going on in, actually, Bishop Arts is kind of a cool area. So Dallas has got these pockets.
Yeah.
The core downtown isn't alive the way you would think of the downtown of a different city being alive. And if they can, I don't have any reason to believe they can't, if they can pull off this pretty significant reinvestment in downtown, I do think it's an interesting acquisition. This is why I wanted to bring it up on our podcast today.
Well, Dallas, I love Dallas. I love everything about Dallas. I think downtown is, I'll say this. I love the farmer's market. Todd Interest, well, there you go. Todd Interest, guys are no joke. And doing that project this close to this thing, that close to the farmer's market, in Texas, in Dallas, you have my attention.
And you've got some institutional ownership on the multifamily side here in this pocket of downtown too, which this is obviously a herd mentality, but if Camden and some of these other publicly traded REITs have planted flags here, that would also bring comfort from my perspective.
Yeah.
So talk about, Elliot, you get this dropped off on your desk. What's the first page that you flip to?
Not the pro forma.
Not the pro forma.
I don't know, though. Every time I see a broker pro forma, I'm starting to play this. Although I guess you're too much of a big shot now. We can do the pro forma. But for your analyst, please express my condolences. I have never once ever looked at a broker pro forma and thought, there's the other man. We're cuts, and this has been a lot of time with us. Anyway. So
it's a big red flag anytime a buyer interview call comes up and you get behind their underwriting and they've made all the same assumptions and used your pro forma in their underwriting. I would tell you that is not a good sign.
Yeah, 60% of the time works every time. So Eric, the first thing I'm looking at here, and we talk about this at the office a good amount, the first question is, do I understand why people would want to live in this submarket? It's kind of the first thing. I'm not even looking at the numbers. We're not underwriting yet. We're just looking for, like you said, this page here with Todd Interest. We're looking at proximity to downtown, CBD, and jobs. With this item, it's pretty easy for me to say, okay, I can fundamentally understand why people would choose to live in the submarket. Pricing may be wrong. Building may be wrong. We're not there yet. But I want to go, do I believe that people want to be here? It doesn't seem sticky. So I'm looking through really for any data on economic activity, job growth, single family homes, pricing, median family income, all that kind of stuff. That's really the first thing for me. And then if I like the market and you can see that there's definitely some interesting things going on here, then the question is goes from the submarket to the building. Do I think that people want to live in our building? And again, that's separate from pricing and all that. Does our building seem relatively attractive? Do I understand who the renters would want to be? That's probably the first place to start.
Okay, so then is that me? So you're looking at these outside photos, you're looking at floor plans.
Yeah.
One would assume.
Yeah, I'm looking at
And then I guess at some point you get going through that funnel, and then at some point you're going to say, okay, how do these rents stack up to how does that jive with this market? People want to live in the area, they want to live in this building, and then I guess at some point you're putting a price on how much you think that those first
yes.
two things
are. Yeah, true. Exactly. So then the next step for me is I'm looking at, I sort of cynically joke that there's only two kinds of real estate. This is like core and value add and distress and opportunity, all that just in court plus. All seems like things that GPs who have missed return targets have made up over the years. So that was never a value add deal. That was always court plus. So I just don't think that, I don't think it's that nuanced. I think there's real estate that is in good shape, that's been well taken care of. And you just want to buy it and own it because you like the market. And then there's real estate that you think you can buy and improve. And so we're looking at this deal. I don't think there's really anything for me to do to improve here. It's been well taken care of. You've got cool units. They put money into the common spaces. It's funky, but that's attractive in its own right. And so I'm just looking at, okay, there's nothing I'm going to do to improve this asset. So what do I believe to be true about the rent that we could see here? And what do I think I could run for? Is there any deferred maintenance I need to pay for? And then from there, I'm really just solving for term. So I'm looking at the rents. These units are hard to come. Some of them are huge. And mm-hmm. it's really, you have to spend a lot of time trying to let out, okay, well, we have a 1,300 square foot one bedroom. How much more expensive should that be than 750 square foot one bedroom that's across the street in a slightly newer building? So it's a really tough one to work because you're not just comparing apples to apples. They're not both 2010 built kind of typical building for it's easy to get cool. So you spend a lot of time trying to figure out what are people doing here.
I think I would, I think I was reminded of a great quote the other day by this cat, John McNellis, who's a really bright and funny guy, is a shopping center developer in California. And he said, all happy real estate deals start the same way, which is with a motivated seller. Mm-hmm. So in this one, or anything like this, I think after the, you know, yes on the why do people want to live here, market, why do people want to live in this building, who are these people, and then at some point you probably got to address who's on the other side of this transaction and what is their level of motivation. Why do I want to be buying from them? Why do they want to be selling? And how much do they want to get rid of it? And I was thinking about that, and everything that we've done that has held to be true. The best deals that we've made have been with the most mm-hmm. motivated sellers. The worst deals that we've made are with the least motivated sellers. And not always, but generally falls along somewhere along that spectrum.
It kind of goes into the guy that wants the least wins, right?
Yeah. So in looking, just flipping through this, you know, there is a bit of an albatross element to this of, yeah, it's got a hotel. Yeah, it's an old building. Yeah, they're big units. It's in a, let's say, emerging part of a good market. There are reasons for a seller to potentially be motivated on something like this.
There certainly are. The challenge, so I think their motivation really just comes from I'm pretty sure this deck, they're in sort of a fixed or closed in fund. They bought this deal. They put a lot of money into it. They did the renovations. And so to some extent, they have really realized their business plan. And you time out realizing the business plan with the end of a fund life, this seems like a natural sale.
but they're not credit even the fund like to get it. And they're really trying to push pricing. And one thing that stuck out to me, I really like this. Mine's just been a mocking it down a lot. There was two things that concerned me. The first, in terms of rents, the rents felt like they were above market. And they were above market in such a way that it wasn't just that I thought, well, they're 1,300 square foot one bed is priced in high, something like that. They felt above market in that a lot of the leases are master leases to large companies. Companies have a real presence at these conference centers. They need housing for their employees. And so they're master leasing chunks of these buildings. And so you go through the rent roll and you got 237 units, I think. And I think there was maybe 80% of the rent roll was occupied by 10 or 12 companies.
Wow.
And so when I adjusted those rents down to market, because you don't want to assume that they're going to stay and you don't want to really price your model off them staying. When I adjusted rents down to what I believe the market, and frankly, a lot of it was looking at the other 20% of just individual renters, and their rents were cheaper. Right, they weren't going to pay this premium for a block of rooms, so their rents were cheaper.
Uh-huh.
And so when I adjusted those down, my personal analysis for, okay, if I can't retain these companies or they don't stay, then what is this going to look like? I wasn't able to get to their pricing. The returns were just a little too thin for me. That's the first thing that stuck out. Second thing, which is related to the rent, but not related to the rent, is this parking garage situation. The parking here, there's not enough parking for the residents to self-park. There's a zoning regulation in Dallas that you have to have a certain number of spaces per unit for self-parking. I don't know exactly what that is off the top of my head, but so they have to have a valet parking company. And it's expensive. They're losing, I think, you know, midway in a year or whatever on providing the valet service because maybe they're not 100% full or not all the residents are using it. I don't know exactly, but you wouldn't be able to remove it because the city of Dallas requires fewer parking spaces if you have a parking attendant. But the residents don't actually like this feature. I mean, you could probably think, oh, well, that's nice. It's valet parking, and it's great on a Sunday if you're out running errands and you come back and someone deals with your car. But fundamentally, everyone is trying to get to work at 9 a.m., and you have one parking attendant or two parking attendants. There's a line for cars. People getting upset. So from my understanding, the feedback from the residents is we don't want this. So you have parking that's not great. Then you have to look at expanding the garage. But that's a whole lot of structural work and concrete and steel. You could be looking at $1 million or $2 million project just to get the parking sorted out. And that doesn't really drive rent in the same way that an upgraded unit does. So that's almost deferred maintenance. And so it was a way to look at it. So those are two things that stuck out to me, and I thought I just can't quite get there on price. And it's there to your point, they're interested, but not motivated in the classical sense of it's time to transact, let's read the market, let's go.
And Elliot, just to jump in here for the audience benefit, I know you talked about kind of the closed-ended fund nature there, but I think for the audience, it might be good to have you unpack that a little bit more and exactly what that means for those that might not
know. Sure. So, most typical real estate investment funds at a GP like me, like Eric, is going out. We're talking to a bunch of investors. We're raising money. We're saying, here's our investment thesis. Eric, I think if I'm correct, Eric's bread and butter deal is a single tenant, less than 5,000 square foot industrial building in an expensive part of town that's got paved parking. Is that probably right, Eric? Feels good.
Feels
so
good.
Eric's going to raise a fund around that piece. We're going to look for these things. We're raising $100 million and we're going to buy them. We believe that our approach will yield above market returns for XYZ. It's a pretty good pitch. So if Eric raises $1 million, part of this conversation is it's going to take me 2 years to invest. And maybe it's both. We have a 2 year investment period and then we have a 5 year hold period. And then I'll get into money. And so that's just the business. So at some point, Eric has invested all $100 million. He's owned these properties for somewhere between 5 and 7 years depending on how early he bought and he's holding on. And so you get towards the end of the fund, and Eric's investors are expecting their capital to be returned, so there has to be a sale. There's always some exception, I guess, but by and large, the timing of bought funds dictates the sale. And so I think these guys are in one of those vehicles, but they are, maybe they have another year or 18 months before they really do need to sell. So right now they're selling opportunities. If we find somebody who's going to be in our boat, we will transact. If we don't, then we're gonna keep holding. And so that's basically, I don't know how helpful that was, Brett, but that's
kind of Yeah. And I guess like these last couple deals that are in funds, the manager of the fund can kind of say, all right, well, I've got to sell these last two deals to close out the fund, which then kind of unlocks additional promoted dollars to the sponsor here, or something along those lines, right? I mean, so there could be additional motivations here. I mean, to close out the fund, you get all the money released, return to investors, and kind of move on to the next fund.
Yeah, those are certainly motivated sellers. And then the other challenge that we have is, and this is more, I guess, but a lesson is you've got most of these people measured on internal rate of return or IRR, the common metric. That's just how they benchmark against other funds. And shows three of us could go on today is about how it's not necessarily the best metric, but it is a metric, but it's industry standard. And the longer you hold something, the lower your IRR, I mean, for the most part, right? And so sometimes these GPs are looking at, okay, is the hold, if I'm going to hold this for another 18 months, is that hold worth the IRR decay? Right? I could sell today, make a little bit less money, but I can get an 18, or I'm going to sell in 18 months and I'm going to get a 15. I'm out fundraising again, it's just more impactful to say that we have an 18 IRR versus a 50. You get into a lot of that at the end of the fund, these GPs who are motivated to shoot that.
Sure. And I think that that's a really important fact, the levered internal rate of return. So I think a lot of folks, even folks in the business, kind of say, well, I'm going to hold it for a year because I'm going to make more money. But really, you're not putting as much money in your pocket at the end of the day if you're the owner. Because to your point, you're measured on a leveraged internal rate of return, which moving the capital event up 12 months certainly moves the needle a lot more. And I heard a stat or kind of a talking point here from a multi-family developer a couple years ago that on a typical multi-family development deal with a third-party equity partner, a limited partner, you would have to increase the value of the property by $10,000 a door every quarter to break even, which I think you just put that in context. So holding it an extra year, you'd have to increase the value of the property by $40,000 a unit. And I think we'd all agree today that's just not happening, and we're seeing a lot of sellers making the election just to hold the deal and wait. And when you work through the math exercise, net, it's hard to believe you wouldn't end up in a better spot selling it today, even in a challenging market.
And then I think the end of fund is, there's no sweeter words sometimes. And there's also a little bit of ambivalence that comes too. Like if somebody's at the end of a fund and they've raised their next one, and especially if they're out of the money on the first one, they could really care less. And just being done with it saves administrative costs, et cetera. So sometimes that can be a really, really good time to make friends.
Yeah, I agree.
I love hearing this is our last deal in the fund as much as sellers love hearing 1031 exchange.
That's right. And then the corporate lease comment too, Elliot, to circle back to that, because I think a lot of folks would say, well, if I've got a lease from 10% of the property to a corporation versus, 15 different individuals, that's probably a good thing. But when you get into the financing component there, that has very punitive effects for most lenders out there.
Yeah, I mean, you just get into customer concentration risk. It's really one way to say, right? You've got these tenants, and you should not be diverse. If they're going to decide to not renew that, you've got 22 units, you have police all over the site. So they're coming in the cab, they're going to be really kissing. And we're not talking about super long term. It's not like an industrial lease. it's our entrepreneurs. They're not signing 10-year leases with Escalate. A lot of them just, they're committing to a 1-year lease. So you don't have as much diversity in the rent roll. You have really kind of chunky vacancy, which isn't much fun. And that chunky vacancy gets hard to get rid of because you literally see the individuals. You're still trying to lease all these units really quickly. So you would get these bumps in your rent roll that are really hard to lease.
The other thing about these bigger units, a lot of times, as you'll see a marketing at a lower per square foot rate, which on the face of it seems attractive.
It's fine. Just
the cumulative effect of a bigger unit, though, can mean a higher monthly nut for people, and total dollars for, say, on a per square foot basis, they might seem cheap, but on a total dollar basis, seem to get real expensive pretty quick. I would imagine this might be one of those.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And then I would guess, you know, a corporation, I think that's smart about, you know, a corporation might have different motivations for leasing a block of apartments. Might be near their office, might be have that sort of a work convenience, but doesn't have a life convenience. That, you know, how far it is to the grocery store might be a secondary.
Well, and that's really the hope behind, you can see now some of the new development, the whole global development. That's going to be a big mixed use retail, restaurant, office, it'll be a whole thing. That once you're direction, now you're renting this ton of things. First, right now, I mean, it's not food desert. Fumigate is just not the worst drivers there. But as president, maybe there's not as much effect. Maybe you're a few more blocks away from where you'd like to be. Which don't you can discount there. We talked about that a little bit. But yeah, it looks the same, but how far away are we doing the better things?
So you get to this point, you've got a check mark by the why would people want to live in the market. You got a check mark by why people might want to live in this building. You've identified some of the big gotchas, the parking, the corporate nature of these master leases, some of the other nuances. You've got a hotel, you've got retail, you've got, here's all the issues with this thing. You've got to come to a price. So let's assume there is a, as with every property, there's a value. You want to come to a price that you feel good about on something like this. What's your next step?
So steps? With something like this, because there's not a lot that I can do to improve it, assuming I'm comfortable with some of what's going on around me, I'm going to look to sound cliche. First thing I'll do is I'll look at, well, you know, where's the 10-year today, the 10-year trip, you know? That is the risk-free.
424, unfortunately.
That is, thank you, great news for us. Anyway, I look at the 10-year, which is, you know, for the listeners, it's your risk-free rate of return, right? You can just put the money there and you get 4.2. So whatever you want me to do other than that means to generate a better return, get the risk. But so I look at something like this and try and get comfortable with what's the additional risk premium. Maybe that's 150 basis points, maybe it's 200 basis points. And so I'd say, all right, well, let's go for a spread of 200 basis points above the 10-year for a stabilized yield on cost. And so basically that just means I want my NOI, once I'm done with closing costs and whatever renovations or improvements or rent adjustments we're going to make, that NOI divided by the total dollars that have gone in for purchase price, closing costs, rehab dollars, whatever. The total cash coming through the door every year divided by the purchase price will give me some percentage. You know, divided by the all costs will give me some percentage. Number. I want that to be in 6.2 or 6.25% for a citywide deal. And so that's how to kind of solve for the purchase price. And then the IRR, the equity, they're really just an output.
there should be an output. People like to think of them as an input, their output.
And so then it's just how much leverage am I comfortable taking on? We've got 60% leverage. So on something like this, we'll talk to maybe a 15, 16 IRR. We probably need to get a 2X over
right.
You know, a 5-year period is kind of where this more, it's not very perfect product, but this more core stuff. You know, do you feel pretty comfortable about the execution methods? Is it really why we're drilling into those rents? And what do I believe to be true about the rent today? Not the corporate rent, but the rent of all corporations that were out of here. You know, prevention time is going to have to be shut down for a year to be in ambition. Who am I renting to? What rent cost command? Yeah, and it's proper support. So from there, I got to a number on this deal. I think it was around 40. 46 million, 47 million. I think the seller wanted to be, you know, higher than that, 53, 54. There was a bit of a spread. And it just kind of felt like, well, they don't really need to transact. I don't really need to buy. And we had great conversations, but it just didn't end up making sense for it to be a transaction. Doesn't mean it can't change and we don't take another rent out in the future.
Well, and so on that topic,
and you were dealing with just the residential.
Yeah, just the residential. Right? I just don't know enough about hotels.
So I think these kind of deals have a nice funk to them when you've got multiple product types, and when one of those product types is a hotel.
I had to take the retail too. The retail and residential.
Then things get
weird.
Those
are somehow connected. So there are, I think, 4 or 6 retail condos on the first floor. It's not condos. And so I just sort of priced those and said, I'm not confident I can do any better than the market rent we got on the last couple of leases. So let's assume it takes us 6 to 12 months to lease those up at whatever that rent is. I don't know enough about retail and speculate other than that. And so I looked at residential and retail. Yeah, hotel, if you had an operating partner who you trusted, you know, Brett was a hotel guy. We looked at this kind of thing and we thought, okay, well, I think I can get here on the residential. You can do this at the hotel. Having a parking, it'd be a ton of fun. If you're a big vertically integrated shop and you have those divisions, could also make sense. But I just, you know, we try to stick to what we know.
And I think kind of going in a different direction from the corporate leases and given why the corporate leases are there, it would be interesting from a short-term rental operator how they might look at this, like a Casa, for example, or some of these groups that are focused on that. I would think that might be interesting. I don't think they're probably interested in having 237 units, right. But that may be an alternate use there for at least a portion of the units.
For sure.
I love that. Oh, there's a great quote, Jim Barksdale, who was the Netscape founder, said, all businesses either bundling or unbundling. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, that's kind of where the opportunity are. Spotify allows you to, or Apple Music would allow you to listen to single songs instead of buying the whole album, or, you know, vice versa. Maybe a little bit of that kind of play here. I'll take your hotel. I'll take the whole thing at once. And then I'll unbundle it. The other thing about hotels is they've got a quirkiness to them that has a much wider range of values that could make this type of thing might be a bit of opportunity in that. But you weren't getting any love, it sounds like, Elliot, at kind of 90% of ask.
No, I wasn't. And I think, look, it didn't trade. So either, if someone got close to it, I don't think my number, it wasn't a low ball, but I think it was probably a fair number for the ball. I guess, I suppose, every five, he whispered, would I think it was like that? I think it's a fine number. I wasn't getting a ton of luck, but they also just didn't seem to be, they seem to be kind of efficient, which is fine, right? They're not to the point where they need to sell. But can't go broke, not overpaying for stuff. So I thought, well, we'll just sort of sit tight. It comes our way and does. Can't win every deal. Can't show up every fight you're late to.
Yeah, I think one of my
did you get a holiday card from them?
I don't think they put me on the distribution
list. Go ahead, Brett.
Now, what was that, Brett?
I was going to say, you know, kind of what I think about here, and I went to school in Dallas and spent a lot of time there, have some great clients there. But my big question here is why would you lease a unit here as a resident when you could go, you know, a mile north to Uptown, which just has a lot more gravity to it and a lot more to do. And that's probably, again, that's very high level, but that's the way I think about a lot of these multifamily properties, is why is the resident going to live here relative to competition? And I think we touched on it at the beginning, but you've got some pretty dynamic pockets of town right outside of downtown, that from a resident perspective, I would be more drawn to. And then another thing is when you look at Dallas, the Dallas MSA, and you look at what's going on up at Plano and Legacy West and some of the places in North Dallas where it seems like a lot of the corporate jobs are going instead of downtown. So, I mean, I do believe this area, its best days are to come, especially if some of the ancillary or surrounding developments take place. That's a game changer. But where things stand today, it seems that the center of gravity in Dallas is trending north along the tollway versus into downtown. One of the other things that I'd say is from this.
Hold on. Before you get there, can we just stop and say, the thing that stuck out in that was I went to school in Dallas. You kind of don't hear that, like, I went to school in Boston.
Right. Well, I went to school in the Harvard of Highland Park, Dallas. So I kind of went to school in Boston.
Did you go to SMU?
And
just remember at SMU, we were cheating before cheating was cool.
SMU, right? I didn't know.
Way out in front of the NIL.
I didn't know you were undercover preppy like that.
Well, I was wearing gold chains and cargo shorts, being a public school kid from Orlando. I wasn't the most popular kid there. I was getting a lot of side eye looks from people. Look at this kid from Florida wearing gold chains and cargo shorts with his cool Abercrombie. And let's be honest, I didn't have the right credit cards there either, Elliot.
So Braden, Chip, and Tripp did not invite you to brunch often?
No. Well, they did. I just forgot my wallet, or actually my money was no good to them.
Yeah, I cynically say there's always a reason people will live in your building, and it's often press. And
yep, I agree.
It's a cool building, but you're right about the geographic, kind of like its location and the economic activity and things are trending north. It's got to be priced at a rent that you really believe in. Sorry, Eric, go ahead.
That you have conviction in.
So, Elliot, we kind of started with here's why people want to live here. Here's, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense. How much weight do you give to, in the context of that, how am I going to get out of this? How am I, are the trends working in my favor? Brett's talking about, you know, going that maybe institutional money is moving out on the tollway and not into downtown, for example. If that were the where does that start to weigh into your decision matrix?
Yeah, the go no go decision for me really came down to, you know, we kind of have an initial agree on pricing, but for us to move forward with something like this, you've got to really get comfortable with what is the economic activity that's happening in that particular area. And so these large development projects that are underway or proposed, the convention center, Tokyo International stuff, those kinds of things, you have to have real visibility, not just into, yes, they've been permitted and approved, but I want to see site work. I want to know that this is happening, because there's lots of projects all over the country that have been approved and never gone there. And so you've got to feel like there is some significant institutional capital flow coming into that market. That's what would help push me, because, you know, you can get 60, 50% return in lost markets. Right? So the thing that's going to kind of help push me one way or another is how confident do I feel in that return, how much support for that institutional support for me. Because if you don't have that, you just very dumb report, because you're listening to your exit. What's that look like?
Okay, so let me ask you this. You, on these exercises, we always try to get to try to get to a price. For sport, we'll leave the hotel out of it today. You with a significant amount of thought and visits and underwriting, got to a number at some point in the past. That was this fall, I think you said. If you were offering today with no additional information than what you had at the time you made that offer, is that number higher or lower today or about the same?
Well, I haven't done any additional research into those projects. This was a year ago that I took a look. Most I know more about the far or not. When I offered a year ago, interest rates were a little worse than they are today, but I don't think my number is higher. Eventually, I get all that same number, but I would need to go. I need to push my number up, saying it's like 47 million. I would need to go back to that site, and I would need to see these, the convention center, Tokyo International Harlow, some of these other stuff. I'd need to see those actively happen. Construction going on. But I go down there, all of a sudden it looks the same. This doesn't feel like a great time the market to be breaking ground on new projects. I could totally be wrong about that. So if I'm not seeing other developers, large developers, making multi-billion dollar bets down here, I think I'm going to say, you know what, I'll just pick a different fight.
Yeah, and I would say too, Elliot, from a year ago, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would think from most potential buyers today or investors, folks are taking a more conservative view on rents today for a variety of reasons than they were 12 months ago.
Yeah. Our level of conservatism on this particular show was centered around, I don't believe these corporate rents are as sticky as the rents that are also seen in the same. So that's what I have to.
So you mark the rents, you mark
and in
the in-place rents lower.
And when you're doing that, when you're, are you doing a, are you doing like a full-on space-by-space kind of, model on something like this? Are you not getting that granular with these things and just saying, I'm going to take all these corporate leases and mark them back down to the what I think
so is? It is the, we break up the world and look at every single unit. So our model, we could have, you know, 300 units, I guess, 3 units. But if it's at all this, it's you have an 816 square foot one bed and 894 square foot one bed. Those are different units. Not just in size, but the layout.
Yeah.
Like one and more window. So you're going through these fixes. You are finding the rent that you believe to be true. I say this all the time. The only question we ask would be obvious, and what is true? And so we try and find what is true about that rent. And if you have lots of different unit types, you're going to have lots of different rents. We're going to take all of those corporate leases and knock them down to what we believe the street rent to be at that point. And street rent is what if Brett walking off the street willing to pay? He's not going to pay a premium because he's not a company. And so the net effect was that
right.
We were.
I think we've got a title. I think we got a title for this episode.
What is true?
What is true?
Yeah. I say it several times a day. What is true?
Yeah. Well, I got to jump here in a minute, guys. So I'll let you guys wrap up. But I would say one of my closing comments is that the Dallas Public Library, the Eric Johnson Library, is two blocks away from this. And it has one of, I think, 150-ish of the original Shakespeare folios in it. And I would say, I went and looked at this thing, and it's got an aura about it. But whatever Shakespeare was talking about was true. I can tell you that. And nobody knows anything about this guy, Shakespeare. But yet there's a festival in every city, small, big, across the country. Nobody knows anything about him. So on that note, I'm going to jump and let you guys finish up here. Enjoyed it, and we'll look forward to picking it up next week, guys.
Sounds good, Brett.
And that's the truth.
That's
from
the truth.
Mic drop,
yeah.
Truth. Two gentlemen from Verona.
So, Eric, we've got,
I think we've kind of reached maybe some sense of a logical conclusion. I don't want to drag this on for too long for people who are listening. Anything you think we need to cover?
No, you hit the high points. I think this was underwritten. You got to a price. Times have changed, and the numbers less today.
That is true. That is true.
Great market, great city. submarket that's maybe a bit out of favor, but could be coming back. Therein lies right, the opportunity, exactly right. But it's not to be overpaid for today.
That is exactly right. I think if it is the right opportunity, you'll be thrilled. You'll be thrilled with how this turns out because there'll be a lot of reinvestment in that market. But you don't. That should be nice to have, not critical for the deal to work. It's probably the best way to say it.
Yeah, there's always this the deals that always scare me are the when there's a binary
yeah.
outcome, either A or B is going to happen because it tends to be not the one you want all the time, and so making a bet on a turnaround of downtown, if you've got to pay for that. That might not be a good feeling.
LPs will never remember if you got them a 16% return or a 12% return on a deal. A couple of years from now, it just won't occur to them. But they will always remember when you went full supernova and lost all their equity on a deal. So keep that in mind. Be careful out there.
Yeah. Full supernova. I love it.